there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Makeshift Stories presents a monthly journey into the improbable.
This month's story, episode 154, Depatterned, read by Baltal Kenny. Somewhere in some time, you might be forced to reconsider whether your memories are really your own.
The memory is like a burnt-in afterimage on an old cathode ray tube, a constant ghost behind the picture, faintly etched on the surface of my consciousness, ready to reemerge when my mind is blank or when I'm relaxed enough for the perpetual motion of anxiety to fade. I'm convinced if you opened my skull, you would see it incised on the gyre of my brain, and it's on a random hair trigger which manifests unpredictably. Tonight, it's the landing light of a jet on final approach, rumbling through the quickly fading dusk of a fall sky. Beyond the plate glass windows of the Dustin Donuts tent pegged into the asphalt of a parking lot just beyond the chain link of an airport fence. I checked my phone while standing in line to place my order, and I'm pretty sure the jet was her flight, so it wouldn't be long. I lost the battle to concentrate on the present, and the memory insisted its way back to the surface to reclaim my consciousness. The oily mist. I can feel its cool, clammy fingers cling to my skin, making me shiver. The memory always starts with the same sensation and images. The mist and the feeling of something alien reaching out for me in the fog. Then, the evening sky explodes in light, beams piercing through a mysteriously murky atmosphere, accompanied by strange sounds and a smell I will never forget. I feel like vomiting. Even now, the sensation is so strong. There is a light floating near the treetops, burning the needles off the spindly pines. Then, menacing shadows moving through the safety of our flashlights, my parents yelling, picking us kids up and running blindly through the bush and scrub. A low, gut-shaking sound, louder than an explosion, turns my insides to jelly. More yelling, more strange noises. Knife-edged fear, and I'm swept off my feet into the air. Then darkness, and nothing. My eyes are suddenly open, but I can't focus. Lights and voices I can't understand whirl around me. They spin like a top with me at the vortex, until the prick of something sharp in one shoulder. Then darkness closes in again.
Mister, are you okay?
The question knifed through the rogue, chaotic memory, bringing me back to the gaudy plastic vinyl interior of the donut shop, where I now stood at the front of the line.
I'm just waiting for someone.
A lame excuse I hoped covered my involuntary slide into the past. The short woman behind the order counter, with her dark graying hair bunched under a net and jammed into a Dustin D baseball cap, looked relieved. Apparently, she had bought my excuse.
Can I get you something, then?
There's a lineup, you know. Not polite to hold it up. Not sure what to order, I looked over at a table with two elderly women. Strike that. Two women, probably younger than me, sat engaged in intense conversation, nursing light brown coffees which had gone cold with neglect. Small coffee, double cream, double sugar.
That'll be $3.95, sir. How are you paying?
I held up my debit card. I didn't remember taking it out of my wallet and swiped. The woman motioned me along.
Next!
She bellowed at the couple standing behind me. I moved down past the donut display case to the end of the counter beside the plate glass window which afforded a view of the parking lot and waited for my coffee. At that moment, the lights of a rideshare beamed through the window as it entered the parking lot, momentarily making the kid's metallicized plastic name tag glisten.
"Hi, I'm Tom,"
it proclaimed, the black letters briefly standing out in the glare until the car turned away. I wrapped the styrofoam cup in a paper napkin so I wouldn't burn my fingers and turned to watch a middle-aged woman get out of the back of the rideshare, a heavy-looking tote bag slung over one shoulder. She paid the driver, then made her way to the glass doors and pushed through. The harsh LED lighting of the donut shop interior acted like a Photoshop filter, sharpening her features to the point that I almost didn't recognize her. But she was the person I had been waiting for. I waved to get her attention. "Mr. Petrenko!" She yelled loud enough for a few of the patrons to break off their conversations to look up to see who had so rudely interrupted them. I still wasn't sure I wanted to follow through with this meeting. My lizard brain was insisting I run. But after all these years, I was desperate for an explanation of what happened to us. So instead, I smiled and walked over to where she was standing. "You look a lot younger than your photo."
"And you look older," she laughed.
I didn't like getting my picture taken. The one on my profile page is 10 years old. I admitted, feeling my face heat up. Her eyes slid down to the coffee in my left hand.
"Oh, sorry. I wasn't expecting you so soon after your flight. Let's find a table and I'll get you one. What do you want?"
Tea! Oolong, if you have it. Black."
We found a table in an empty corner of the donut shop, and I left her there to get settled in while I stood in line for her tea. Marie had found me online after reading one of my more popular posts about the reoccurring dreams and uncontrolled flashbacks. Most people, if they believed me at all, told me I had PTSD-like symptoms, but Marie had claimed she had another explanation, one she could only tell me face to face. Intrigued, but wary, I had agreed to the meeting. I could feel the dampness beginning to claw up my arm and the afterimages burning their way back into my consciousness when the lady behind the till barked at me impatiently. I wasn't sure how long I'd been standing there, gaping at nothing.
"What do you want, mister?"
"A tea, black." The place only had tea listed on the bright LCD panel behind the counter, so I concluded asking for oolong was pointless. Embarrassed, I had started to slide from the present again. I quickly paid, picked up Marie's tea, and wove my way between the backs of chairs haphazardly draped in winter jackets to our table.
"Thank you for the tea, Ivan."
Marie sipped at it experimentally, testing its temperature, watching me with an analytic eye. She waited for me to settle. My gaze fell onto her heavy-looking tote bag. "Is that the evidence?"
"Yes, I brought my father's notebooks and case files. He collected everything he could find on your incident. Newspaper clippings, photocopies of microfiche articles, that sort of thing."
My curiosity was overwhelming my caution.
May I?"
I asked, beginning to reach across the table.
"Did you have a flashback just then while you were standing in line?"
No, not really. Why?"
"It looked like you froze when you got to the front of the line. Do you know what the triggers are? Does it happen often?"
I shrugged. "Like I've said in my posts, it's mostly random. Stress may be a factor. At least, that's what I've been told. I've had the lapses since I was 8. They're just part of my life now."
Marie's features softened. I hope what I've brought will finally help."
"Okay, then. Let's take a look," I suggested, impatiently wanting to find out if this meeting would be worthwhile.
"I know your story, but I'd like to hear it from you. There are so many versions of it floating around on the web. I'd like to hear the original first."
Sure. The question caught me off guard. I had told her story so many times, recalling it had become a reflex. "Okay." I sighed and took a sip of my now lukewarm, oversweetened coffee before I started. I was 8 at the time. It was summer, 1956. You know I'm the youngest of 2 kids, right? My father passed away in the 80s, my sister 2 years ago. And my mother, you should know about from the stories, that makes me the last survivor. The last living person who was there. I didn't know about your sister, Marie apologized, concentrating on her tea bag to avoid looking at me. I haven't posted anything about my sister online, so you would have no way to know. Anyway, I continued, my parents had decided to take our summer holiday in the north to escape the dusty August heat of the Midwest. We ended up at a place called the Pine Haven Campground at Wabagoon Lake, Ontario. I've been back several times since to get answers. I still don't understand why my parents chose that place over hundreds of others. It isn't exactly pristine wilderness. Far from it. The campground was located close to a mill town. You know, one of those places that's come and gone from the map. And you can still tell that in the day it had been a boom town, a place with a secure future, good paying jobs for life, and affordable. That's why people moved there. You could realize the dream, have the bungalow, car, and family. Last time I was there, the plant had closed and the place looked like the party had ended decades ago. Even the giant moose on the side of the highway into town had lost its brave face. It looked like it had finally recognized the future would never arrive. At least, that's what its state of repair seemed to suggest. No one had bothered to remove the graffiti, and a hind leg was partly falling off. The area is just another broken mid-20th century promise, tarnished beyond recovery. The campground where we stayed is gone, turned into the local landfill. However, that's besides the point, isn't it?
No, these are the details I was hoping to hear.
Marie plucked out the teabag, then picked up her cup and cradled it in both hands. I nodded, thinking. In some ways, I wish the area had been able to capitalize on what happened to us, so they could have become a Northern Roswell or something like that. At least then, something positive would have come from it all. It's a bit of a pet peeve for me, I explained. We were there for 2 weeks during the Perseid meteor shower. My parents liked watching the night sky. Maybe the Pine Haven Campground was the best place to watch it that year. I don't know. It was around midnight. My parents had woken us up to see the meteors. They brought blankets and air mattresses. We walked for about 15 minutes into the bush until we came to a rocky, treeless ridge. We climbed to its top, got the air mattress inflated, wrapped ourselves in blankets, then laid down to watch the night sky. I remember the stars seemed unusually intense that night.
So it was a cloudless night,
Marie interrupted, putting her teabag down thoughtfully.
In the published versions of your story, you talk about the strange lights in the mist.
I know. I've checked weather records for that week. There was no mention of low-lying clouds or fog, but bear with me. I took a sip of my tepid coffee and stared at Marie, wondering what her true motivation was. I remember seeing a few shooting stars. My parents and sister were excited, but I was cold, damp, bored, and wanted to go back. So I defiantly curled up and closed my eyes, waiting for it to be over. I think I fell asleep. The next thing I can recall is my father waking me. The stars were gone, and we were surrounded by fog. I don't know where it came from, but there was an odd smell, like ozone when there's an electric spark, only more acrid. My father looked frightened. He told us to leave the air mattresses, but I don't think he headed back to camp. I remember him wanting to get to the highway fast. Maybe it was closer. I can't remember. We started stumbling through the woods along an old animal trail. My parents had turned their flashlights off, so we kept tripping on roots and fallen logs, slowing us down. The fog got thicker, making it worse, but we could hear the cars on the highway getting closer. Then they found us, with lasers or Something beamed down through the trees, like searchlights, only they were blue and orange and more intense. One beam found me, and I froze in fear. Dad grabbed me and began to haul me out of its glare, but it was too late. Another orange circle targeted him. Then the air around us seemed to turn into solid crystal, and we were both lifted off the ground, up into the darkness. From there on, my memories jumbled. I can recall lying on a white, harshly lit space, and there were these shadows moving along the walls. For some reason, I couldn't turn my head. It was like my brain had been disconnected from my body. I panicked and tried to yell. The shadows placed something over my nose and mouth, but somehow I managed to flip onto my side. It was then that I saw the other tables. They all had bodies strapped to them. The shadow figures were fussing around with weird instruments experimentally, poking and prodding. I tried to scream, but I couldn't, and it felt like I was gagging. Then I lost consciousness. I don't remember anything after that until we were found. My father remembered more about the room. You've probably read his accounts of what happened. Eventually, a transport truck driver found us on the shoulder of the highway 2 weeks later and 100 miles away. Yeah, I've read the original story in the local newspaper archive. They put it online a couple of years ago. I also have my father's clipping. If I remember right, the headline was "Confused Holidaying Family Finally Found." But that story didn't mention any of this, Maria noted. Initially, my parents told us not to say anything about the abduction, but when my mother got sick a few weeks later, my father called the newspapers and told them the truth. He was worried, and in hindsight, I couldn't blame him. No one believed us. The locals accused us of wandering into a toxic waste dump, but we weren't anywhere near their industrial plant. My mother got worse, and no one could figure out what was going on. A year later, she passed away. My father never gave up. He claimed the authorities were burying the incident, that they knew people were being kidnapped by something and experimented on. I filed several Freedom of Information requests over the years, and guess what? Everything I got back was 90% redacted. My father, sister, and I submitted ourselves to polygraph tests, hypnotism, and anything else that would prove what we've been saying was true. It took over our lives. We were branded as crazy alien abductees. Now, if you have something that can help... I stopped to catch my breath. Marie stared at me like she was trying to decide, like she might be about to change her mind. I just need to know. I almost pleaded. She heaved her tote bag onto the table, then tipped it over, so its contents spilled out. Notebooks, photo albums, and binders. These were my father's. He passed away 6 months ago, and I found them when I was cleaning out his house. His name was Dr. James Allard, a psychiatric researcher. I've never heard of him, I said cautiously, my suspicion of yet another debunking growing. Marie opened one of the albums, flipped to the first page containing a yellowing newspaper clipping, and spun it around so I could read. He followed your story from the beginning. This scrapbook has every media article you or your family's been in. I know there's groups that track things like this. I've been approached and interviewed by most, but I never thought anyone was this obsessed except for me. I flipped through the pages documenting the arc of public interest in what had happened. The initial flurry of articles, the dry spell in the 80s when I took over from my ailing father as spokesperson, and the world had turned away from stories like ours. Then finally the search again in the 90s as specialty cable TV channels hungry for content revived interests in unexplained phenomena. This is my life. This is who I am. I sighed, flipping through the methodically laid out album. Why was your father so interested? Does he belong to one of those groups? They were pointless to talk to. No one takes them seriously. All we ever wanted is official acknowledgement of the truth, and that whatever happened has ultimately led to illness and death. I'm the last one alive, and now I've got something in me as well. No one knows what. It's the same pattern. Marie pulled a red notebook from the bottom of the pile, then hesitated.
I think I can help, Mr. Petrenko, but you've got to be open-minded.
I'm not the one who needs to be open-minded. It's the rest of the world, I pointed out. I could feel my guard going up. I had been through too many interviews where the entire point was to debunk our story or exploit it to support someone else's ludicrous theories. It happened. I'm going to say that up front, and my family's illnesses are real. I lived this, and no one's going to convince me otherwise. Marie carefully placed the notebook at the center of the small table and then looked at me.
I know it happened, Ivan. Something unconscionable occurred, but you're missing some critical facts.
Okay, I sighed. Here we go. Yet another dismissal, right?
No, not at all, Ivan. Just listen. Give me a chance here. I understand your skepticism. Let me add my part to your story. Then you can take it or leave it, use it or ignore it, whatever you want, but you need to withhold judgment until I'm finished. That's all I ask.
I folded my arms defensively and leaned back in my chair. Noting my response, Marie fortified herself with a sip of her tea, then continued.
I know my father wanted to do this himself, but he wasn't able to. His work is still mostly classified, and he was afraid of our family and friends if we went public. But it's been over 60 years, and I didn't sign anything that prevents me from talking. I can say what I want. It will be denied, of course. I have his case studies and notes as evidence.
Marie patted the notebook. Perhaps I had been wrong. So despite my initial apprehension, I was starting to get excited. I reached for the notes.
Let me give you some context before you flip through that, Marie interjected. That's one of my father's case studies. It's about your family. You were brought to him a few days after the accident.
Accident?
It wasn't an accident. Hear me out. My father had a research project funded by the government. His area of investigation was how the human brain creates and recalls memories. Like your family, he was in the area on a vacation. Remember, this was at the height of the Cold War. There was a lot of paranoia about spies and sympathizers and UFOs. Because of the sensitivity of his work, they always knew where he was and kept an eye on him. It's one of the reasons he quit after your case.
Case?
You were his patients for about 10 days. It's in the file. He kept a duplicate which they don't know about.
That can't be right. We were never in a hospital for 10 days, just in overnight for observation after we were found. There was an interview with the police. They wanted to know what happened to us. We claimed we had gotten lost in the dark when we were stargazing. We were eventually examined by a psychologist after my father started talking about our abduction. But that was more than 18 months later. We weren't anyone's patients right after, so we never met your father. I protested.
Marie dug a faded Kodachrome out of the pile of documents on the table and pushed it towards me.
That's my father around the time of the incident. He said they interrupted his holiday, had a car come out and pick him up from the cabin he and my mother were staying in. By the time he arrived, they had set up a special ward for your family in a field hospital they had quickly set up. You can read the details in the case files.
I stared at the photo defiantly and shook my head in denial. No, I've never met him, I insisted. But there was something itching at the corners of my mind which began to question my conviction. Marie nodded, then pushed on. My father was experimenting with a process called de-patterning, where a person is subjected to continuous repetitions of a message while the subject is sedated with a muscular paralytic-like curare. It's not in the files, but I think they sometimes used hallucinogens like LSD as well. It was part of a Cold War project called MK-Ultra. My father was working on a process to change memories so a captured spy wouldn't be able to reveal critical information when they were interrogated. I'm confused. What does this have to do with my family? False memories, Ivan. My father was directed to implant false memories in you to cover up an industrial accident. I don't believe that. There's no record of an industrial accident in the area when we were there. I investigated that theory decades ago, and so did others. There's nothing. Nothing in records they were forced to release, but I assure you it exists somewhere. You were exposed to an unintended release of chemicals from a nearby facility. You must understand, there was a lot of money involved, both private and public. The stakeholders couldn't afford a shutdown. It would have ruined them and killed industrial development in the region. The wind blew the cloud of toxins into the campground. They used some excuse to evacuate the place, the fire or something, but no one could find your family. Anyway, that was the story they told my father. At first, he didn't want to do it, but they threatened his funding and threatened to ruin his career. After, he felt intensely guilty. That's why he collected all this. Marie swept her hands over the pile of files and journals. He wanted you to know, but he was also protecting us, his family. His death changed the situation, and that's why I flew here to give you these files. He would have begged for your understanding. He was a good person, Ivan. He didn't intend to ruin your life.
I didn't know what to say. It contradicted everything I thought I believed in and who I had become. No, it happened. I tried to deny while suspecting it was the truth. We were abducted. It was real. I was there. My family was there. We all experienced the same thing.
I can only guess what this must be like, Ivan. I'm sorry, but it's the truth. The notes and records are for you. Take your time and read through them. Call me if you want.
Marie's phone began to beep. She reached around the orange plastic back chair and pulled it from a coat pocket, thumbing it on.
That's my ride back to the airport. Sorry, I have to leave.
She got up and pulled her coat on, leaving the tote bag and its documents on the table.
I know this wasn't what you were expecting, but it's the truth. I hope it helps bring you closure.
A storm began to grow in the back of my mind. Afraid of what I might blurt out, I said nothing, and instead watched Marie's back in silence as she walked to the coffee shop entrance, then pushed through it into the night. The closing doors reflected the glaring headlights of a car directly into my mind. The fog rolled in around me, this time fouled by a caustic chemical smell, which made me gag.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB Financial. To listen to other great APN podcasts, such as the Northern Nerdcast or Assumptions, please head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com. This episode of Makeshift Stories is brought to you by Park Power, a provider of electricity and natural gas in Alberta that offers low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. In Alberta, you get to choose who you buy your energy from. Park Power has low overhead, and chances are you'll save money if you switch. You can find out how much money you'd save by visiting parkpower.ca and plug in your numbers into the Alberta Energy Savings Calculator. If you decide to switch, it's easy. Nothing changes about your service, only the price you pay. Learn more at parkpower.ca. Makeshift Stories is released once a month between the 15th and the 20th. This month's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Balto Canny, and recorded by David Hume. The opening and closing music was composed and recorded by David Hume. If you'd like to connect with us, please send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. You can help us out by writing a review on Stitcher Radio or Apple Podcasts or any of your favorite podcast services. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution, no derivative license, which means you're free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.